Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
And you just gotta love Hot Tuna. You know what I mean? Hot Tuna was, if you don't know who Hot Tuna was, it was the musicians from Jefferson Airplane. Marty Ballin and all those guys put together a band called Hot Tuna. They were primarily instrumentalists. And that is one of their tunes called Embryonic Journey. So I can see by our guest look on her face that she is saying, something new. I learned something new.
Now, why did they call themselves Hot Tuna? Maybe the mystery we never solve.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those things that I just don't know, which are lumped into a whole bunch of things I don't know.
Yeah, well, you and me both.
Welcome to LA Talk Radio. You were listening to the Writer's Block, and that strange voice you're hearing in the background is our co-host for this evening and forevermore, Mr. Richard Polinelli. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Jim. How's it going?
I'm doing well, thank you. And yourself?
Not too bad, just trying to survive one of the craziest months I think I've ever run into in a while. Yeah. So,
I've been reading your tweets. So. Russ Avison was supposed to be with us tonight. And of course, having Russ on the show is always a treat because he's just a great guy. But he begged off. He's got five more weeks of training on Thursday nights. He's a professional dog trainer for our guest who doesn't know who Russ Avison is. And he is he's actually pretty much world famous. He put together the program for Best PetSmart. And the guy is just like phenomenal. He is just, and he's a terrific, terrific interviewer, even though he's not a writer, but he interviews really well. So we're going to miss you, Russ, but don't come back until you're ready. Okay. What's going on that's new? Let's see. We are somewhere hidden in the mountains of the Sawtooth Range in my little basement studio. Actually, not a basement, but close. Small room studio. And we are, I'm just going to introduce her. We are looking at a writer on Skype right now. And we just love having people on Skype because we can actually look at them. And she is, I'm going to let her introduce herself, at least some of the salient points. Please welcome to the Writer's Block for her first appearance, Ms. L. Annette Binder. Binder. Hello, Annette. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you, Jim. How are you guys doing?
We are exceptional. What does the L stand for? I'm going to guess Louise. No.
No. My first name is Lisa.
That's not German.
Yes, it is.
You know what? My mother wanted an exotic name.
Lisa's so not exotic. I need to talk to your mother.
They were both German, and Lisa is an exotic name, or at least
Lisa, but spelled differently.
Yeah, it's pronounced Lisa in German, and my childhood nickname was always Lisalein, which means little Lisa. And so my mom's the only one left who calls me Lisalein, but she wanted an exotic name, and I guess there was an opera singer named Lisa de la Casa. I'm not familiar with her at all, but she really liked this opera singer, and so she named me after her.
My grandfather was a terrible voice. I'm sure. He had every opera singer ever in the world. Their album covers posted on his wall in his hi-fi room, and he loved opera. Oh. But he was from Sicily. They all love opera. I don't know what it is with the Sicilians and opera. I can't do the opera thing. I just can't do it. It's just not in my blood, although it should be.
Tell
us a little bit about yourself before we get into your book, which is interesting, is an interesting read. But tell us a little bit about yourself.
I was born in Germany and came to the U.S. when I was about 5 and a half. Grew up in Colorado, married a guy from LA and lived in LA for many years. But now we're out in New Hampshire and I've got a 12-year-old daughter and I love living. I'm in the country now and I like living in the country a lot.
Yeah. And you're, this is your first novel or second novel?
No, it's my first novel. And it's actually the first piece of fiction I wrote. Okay. Other than some really bad Agatha Christie inspired stories in junior high school. So it's the first piece of fiction I wrote as an adult. And when I thought it was never going to get published, I put it in a drawer and it sat in a drawer for 8 years. I called it my drawer novel. And I started writing short stories while, you know, I just wanted to focus on something else, something with a different rhythm. So I wrote short stories, put out a collection of short stories that came out in 2012 called Rise, and then went back to this novel.
Okay. You know, Richard and I have a little publishing business, Tuscany Bay Books. And that's one of our hooks is, you know, okay, you finished your book. Now what are you going to do with it? Well, if you're like most writers, you stick it in a drawer with the 6 or 7 other novels you got shoved in that drawer.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I worked about 8 years on the first draft, a very polished first draft that I'd revised multiple times. But it was really, you know, it's still a first draft. And I had some interest from agents, but I had people say, you know what, it's too sympathetic toward ordinary Germans, and I don't think I can sell it. And so I just put it in a drawer about 3 days. I thought, wow, 8 years, that was a long time to spend on something that's sitting in a drawer. And then I thought, no, that's not the right attitude to have. I should be grateful because writing this novel taught me what I look for in language. It taught me what, you know, how I want to write, how I want it to sound. And it just taught me how to write a novel. And so even if nothing else comes of it, it was worth it. And so I set it aside and started writing short stories, which I fell in love with and just didn't look back.
You, well, the name of your novel is Vanishing Sky. It's an interesting read. And you brought up some pretty good points in this book. Germany during World War II, which is where the novel takes place at the end of World War II, I believe in April and May of 1945. Mm-hmm. It's there were pro-Nazis, there were anti-Nazis, but there were a lot of people in Germany that were kind of on the road, on the fence. Mm-hmm. And I found that interesting because I had never heard that many folks on the fence with what was going on. But in your novel, you tend to pick up the fact that there are a lot of fence sitters in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost certain, in fact, I would believe that it was probably because Germany was at that point losing the war. And the people didn't know where to go, and they didn't know which side to follow, the Amis or the Russians or the Nazis or the German army, the Wehrmacht and the SS. So I found it interesting, and you put a lot of German in your book, and I'm going to guess because now I don't know, but I'm going to guess this is a good deal of stories from your family.
That's exactly right. I had started writing, and, you know, if someone had told me I would be writing a book set in Germany, I would have said no. Whose mother would speak to them in German, and I would answer in English. The minute we got to the U.S., that was it. I was not German anymore. Right. And so I found it very surprising that when I started writing fiction, the story that I wanted to write, the story that came to me and the characters that came to me were these German people. But it was really inspired by events from my own family, events I found. And so much of it was inspired by his own childhood and his time in the Hitler Youth.
Yeah, I kind of gathered that. And of course, the youngest son, Georg, he's part of the Hitler Youth at 15 years old. And Max is just returned from, I'm going to assume, from the Eastern Front, where he's half starved to death and sick. And he's the oldest son. And the mother, it was Edda, yes?
That's right.
And the father, Josef, who rues the fact that he lost his ability to be in the military and wants so much to go back and fight, and he can't. He's lost his teaching job. He's lost everything. And I'm sorry if I'm giving away you know, points, but, you know, what we do here. it's a quite interesting story. And Max's deterioration was well done, very well done.
Thank you.
You can almost feel him in the bed deteriorating with each bite of food he doesn't take. you know, and tell us a little bit about the story, because I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, you're right. It's set in the last few months of World War II, and it's really the story of a mother named Edda together, just as starting to break through Germany's Western fortifications. And Edda's older son, Max, has come home from the Eastern Front suffering from a mental breakdown. And she knows that if the authorities find out how sick he really is, that they'll take him from her. And she knows she won't get him back.
Right.
She doesn't know the specifics of what's happening at the psychiatric clinic in the city of Würzburg, which is near her home. But she knows that once he goes in there, he's never coming back out.
Right.
And at the same time, her younger son, Georg, whose character was inspired by my father, is running away from his post in the Hitler Youth and is trying to get back home to her. And it really gave me the chance to explore how different people in the same family, how people in the same family can react so differently to totalitarian regime, to the Nazis, and to what's expected of them.
Yeah, it's, well, I'm going to assume that your father never fell in love with another guy while he was in German youth.
No, not as far as I know, but he did run away from his post and tried to make it back home. So that part is inspiring.
There were a lot of them that did. I've gleaned and what I've been able to read over the years, a lot of the German youth, of course, didn't want to fight, and they left. They just ran away. But if they were caught, of course, they were executed, most of them. And as far as the hospitals for the chronically ill, and they were emptied out and sent to the camps as well.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I found this out after I was well into the story, that the psychiatric clinic in the city of Würzburg, where my family is from, the region where my family is from, was one of the main sites where people with psychological conditions or certain neurological diseases were systematically murdered. And their bodies were actually sent to the medical school for use in dissection. And stunningly, no one really seemed to question why these otherwise healthy young bodies were suddenly available for dissection.
Right.
It just, the level of denial, the level of complicity, but also the level of fear, because you're living in a totalitarian regime. And if you try to express disagreement, you're going to end up dead too, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so really trying to capture what that might have been like to live under, and how different people could react in different ways to that,
right,
was
right.
part of what was going on as I wrote.
Yeah. Go ahead, Richard.
I was just going to say, you kind of encapsulated all that in that village where you had, you know, the mother wanted her kids back. The kids didn't want to be at the front or in the army. And then you had somebody like the doctor who just pops in and examines Max and decides to ship him off to a hospital, and they're not telling the family where Max is. So that was kind of Germany right there. You had the people who were very actively Nazi. You had the people who were kind of indifferent. They just wanted to, you know, live their lives and get their families back. You had people who were probably actively against them, but quietly. And then you had the collaborators, I guess, is the best way to describe the doctor. So, and I don't think a lot of people understand that about that time frame in Germany. Not everybody was running around with the black jackets and the swastika armbands.
Yes,
it wasn't a one size fits all for Germany back then.
Exactly. Right. I think there's a tendency to look on the past and sort of flatten it and sort of think of people either as being total heroes like Oskar Schindler, you know, and sort of putting everything on the line to be heroic, or being just the total villains, the people at the rallies. And what you're missing is all the people in the middle and what life might have been like for them as they were trying to navigate this regime.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and a lot of people also never realize that most of the German army, the Wehrmacht themselves, were not Nazis. They were soldiers. And that was their belief. They were soldiers for the fatherland, for sure, but not necessarily the Nazis. They didn't like the Nazis.
You know, I think that's so true. And I think the regime was so good at indoctrinating children. And so what you had was this whole generation of kids my dad's age. He was born in 1930, who were just completely indoctrinated and who believed that they were doing something heroic. And so they really exploited this sort of generational rift, you know, where you have kids willing to, oftentimes willing to sort of rat out their parents for people who would disagree with the regime because they thought they were doing the heroic thing. And those were the kids after the war who were left looking at their shattered country and having to grapple as adults with what they believed and what they'd done and what they'd been taught. So, you know, there's all these layers that get lost when you just sort of look at these newsreels and just think of it as all sort of, you know, no shades of gray. You just think of it as like, you know, you are the good guy, you're the bad guy, and there's nothing in between.
Yeah, you have a very, very, very poignant scene at the end of the book where these Hitler youth are looking at these pictures of the concentration camps that they're given to by the Americans. And they're all saying the same thing. Oh, it's all lies. It's all BS. This never happened. This is propaganda. We don't believe any of this, except for one kid. And he would not stop looking at the pictures. And he finally just, I think he believed it and walked away. And I you know, we don't know what happened to him after that. But it's pretty interesting that all these kids, they didn't believe what they were looking at. And there's no way you actually could fake those photos.
But you know? look at how many years that the Nazis were in power, and they were basically brainwashing these kids. Everything they did at school, everything they saw on the movies, everything they heard on the radio was this pounding drumbeat of this is the way, and anything else is unacceptable. And so you can't just switch that off.
Right. We're going to take a real quick break. Annette, if you would mind, Ronan's going to shut you off and then recontact you because we're getting a lot of garbled stuff from your Skype. Okay, so you can hang up whenever you're ready. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is Writer's Block. We'll be back right after this short word from LA Talk Radio.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com, find the link that says Be a Host, and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say, and if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com, and listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific for the Writer's Block right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we're back with our guest tonight, Annette Binder.
Yay. I'm having a heart attack right now.
We all are. You do sound better, so your connection's probably a little bit better now.
We did the reset.
Thank you, Ronan.
I was the last one standing, and I'm thinking, great, when we come out of a commercial, what am I supposed to do?
Exactly. if you want to call and talk to our guest tonight, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, that number is 323-203-0815. And when you sat down to write this book, Annette, I'm going to guess you had notes and stuff from your family.
Through the book, as crazy as that. And so I basically wrote it sequentially, two editors and then two Georg chapters back and forth, which is sort of how the book is structured, one by one, you know, it alternates the viewpoint back and forth. And then I didn't outline it till I had a first draft.
The character Etta, very strong woman. I mean, you could tell she's a strong. She's from the country. She's a farm woman that has been grown up very strong, and she's like a fierce dog taking care of her children at this point. And she's not about to let. And she gets so pissed off at her husband Yosef because he really wants to just give Max back, and you know, He doesn't really care what happens to him. He really wants to support the regime, and he can't. He has no way to at this point. And then, of course, Georg, who's trying to get the hell out of there. So you have a mother trying to keep their family together, which really shows a lot of courage on her part and strength. Mm-hmm. And she's a very strong character. And I could see what you would, you'd like to write a story about her, because she is a very strong character.
She is. She's really the heart of the book in so many ways. And it wasn't until I came across a picture of my dad wearing a Hitler Youth uniform that I realized there's another son in this family. At first, it was just the three of them. And then I saw the picture of my dad wearing his Hitler Youth uniform and found out more about my family, because he had never told me anything before he passed away. Everything I found out about him after he died. And that's when I saw the son in this family, and he runs away from his post. And so then the book really took form.
Right, right.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write this?
8 years for a first draft, 8 years in a drawer, just sort of resting like a brisket or something, and then another 2 or 3 years of revisions.
Okay, and who was your editor, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, at Bloomsbury, my editor was Lisa Mayer.
Okay.
Who's a lovely editor, but also my agent, Claudia Ballard, played a huge role in helping me sort of with pacing and sort of, you know, making certain things more clear in the story, because it was just so clear to me. You sort of lose perspective when you're so deep into it. And so she was essential in helping me step back and figure out what still needed to be done.
Yeah, it's never clear to you when you're the writer. Never.
Oh, no. You're so deep in, you really have no idea.
I'm really surprised when my editor comes to me and she goes, you know, this isn't working. I have no idea why this guy's in this town. Why is he here? What put him in this town? And, you know, it's good questions.
Yeah.
Because as a reader, that's something you'd like to know how this guy got there so you can dispose of him correctly.
Yeah.
You know, just because you shoot him, I mean, so how did he get there? Who is he? So, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, a good editor can, and, you know, a good formatter can make a book or break a book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And Richard had a comment, and I liked his comment about the end of your book. The ending is it ends, but it doesn't end on an up note. It ends kind of almost on a down note, which is unusual, but I suppose not for this type of book. But it doesn't really go, it doesn't really have the wherewithal to go any place past that one, the ending of the book. So I'm glad to hear with our pre-show discussion that you said there was no sequel.
Yeah, no, it ends where it ends. You know, I mean, the characters sort of, what happens to them happens, and it just ends where it ends. And it's sort of up to the reader at a certain level to imagine maybe the future for the Georg character in particular.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, even to some extent, Max, right? I mean, even Max's future is kind of up in the air.
You know, it's funny that you say that. In that chapter with the bombing, you know, there's a chapter where the Allies basically firebomb the city of Würzburg. That's the last we see of Edda and Max in the book.
Right.
And, you know, that is a bombing where thousands upon thousands of people died. And I won't say any more than that, other than that's the last we see of them. And Edda's mother and her mother is dead. And that's the last we see of them. So I sort of leave it up to each reader to sort of figure out what that might mean for the characters.
I took it to think that Max was muerto.
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, I hate to give things away, but yes, I think, you know, it's very hard. I write in close third person. So if someone does die, I can't really have the person sort of going, you know, woe is me, I'm dying. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah,
The story ends. And so I leave it at that, and I leave it up to the reader to sort of extrapolate and figure out what happened to these characters, because that seemed like the only true way to do it without sort of making it sort of, I don't know, sort of ridiculous. You know what I mean? Like, that was the true way to do it, given that it was in close third person.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what got you into writing besides short stories and a novel you put in the drawer for 16 years? I mean, you have to, obviously you have a love for the craft.
I do.
But where did that come from?
I've always loved reading, and I've always been a language person. I mean, I grew up bilingual, and I was a language major in college. I did Greek and Latin, and so I've always just loved literature. But it really just came to me that I'd never taken any classes. I just, these characters came to me, and I thought, well, I'm going to follow where they lead me. And once I discovered how much I liked doing that, that sort of feeling of uncertainty and of just getting to know these characters so that they almost seem like real companions, I just wanted to keep doing it.
Uh-huh. Well, I can't blame you. I mean, you know, I started writing at a very young age, probably 12, 13. Short stories. I tried a novel when I was like 14. It didn't work.
Yeah, 14.
I don't even think it went into a drawer. I think it went into the trash. But, you're a young writer, too. Of course, you were a newspaper man for a number of years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I started writing, you know, obviously not professionally, but I started writing when I was probably, I want to say, six, when we were starting moving all over the countryside. So I would write stories in the backseat as we were going from one new location to the other. And then I got serious about it when I was 19. So, yeah, I mean, I've been doing it for, we're coming up on 40 years, and I don't want to admit that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's something I think most writers, you're almost born with it. You have this desire to put a story together first in your head, and then you got to get it on paper so you can show everybody else. And I think that's true for all authors.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think you're right. Well, Richard is a great example of a Texas boy who made good, and there are very few of those.
Oh, you have just started it now, sir.
Oh, no.
I still have family in Texas, and they're probably listening.
I know. I'm a California boy, so you know what do I know?
Okay, now, technically, I was born in California, and because we wandered everywhere, I could claim eight states.
Well, your dad was in the oil business, so you kind of had to go everywhere. Yeah.
Yep. Much.
Yeah. What did your folks do for a living? What did your dad do for a living?
My dad joined the U.S. Army as a German national and in Vietnam when I was a baby. And then was on a military advisory team in Binh Dinh province in Vietnam on a mobile advisory team on that advisory team and saw like real combat there, got a Bronze Star, did his 20 years. And then after that, did what a lot of military guys do in Colorado. He worked as a security guard and did like other jobs and then passed away very young when I was 16. Yeah.
So he must have been down at Fort Carson then.
He was. He was stationed at Fort Carson. Yeah.
Colorado Springs. I've been in Colorado Springs for about 2 years. So yeah, I know where that is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I did. I mean, we all did. I did my stint in Vietnam. I did 2.5 years there with the first Cavalry Division.
Okay.
So we it wasn't a picnic for us either. So no. I totally get that.
Yeah, I actually have pictures, and I was trying to find someone who might have served with him, and I met one person from the advisory team, but not the same mobile advisory team, which was Tony, who knew him as the German sergeant. But other than that, I didn't really meet any. I haven't found anyone yet. But I'm on.
What year was he there? What year was he there?
He was there 69 to 70, because I was like a baby.
So was I.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I was up in I Corps out of Da Nang, actually out of Camp Evans up on the beach. And then we worked off a fire base, Hill 75, LZ Linda.
Interesting. Well, I had all these pictures. He had slides from Vietnam, and so I did a website hoping that someone might recognize something from those photographs. Yeah. You know, it's the German sergeant. But so far, nothing.
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up because the German sergeant, we had a plethora, and I mean a plethora, of ex-Foreign Legion guys in our unit. Mm. Not just in Bathurst, which is when I was in 1st and 9th Cav, but in all of the 1st and 9th Cav, there was a lot of ex-French Foreign Legion guys. And they were always, I mean, the first ones in and the first ones out, usually. But they had no compunction of running into the gunfire. And it always amazed me that I mean, everyone else thought about it. I was a radio telephone operator, so I mean, I kind of had to stay back a little bit. But these guys would just go balls to the wall, right into there. And if they were like they had gonads the size of basketballs. I'm surprised they could run.
Jim was well known for coming face to face with 16-foot cobras. So
I did. Oh my God! Yes, they were huge. They were huge. Don't go away. We're going to take another real short break. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block, and we'll be right back with you with our guest L. Annette Binder right after these words from Tuscany Bay Books.
Congratulations! You finally finished that book. Now, what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other six or seven. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it. And we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com, your answer to getting your book published. And right now, we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And we are back with our guest, L. Annette Binder. And, of course, Richard Polinelli, our guest host for tonight and soon to be permanent again. Yeah. Well, actually, next week.
Next week, I'm back.
That's right. And again, the numbers here in the studio with 323-203-0815. And if you want to call and talk to our guest, feel free. The lines are open. Annette, what is your process like? When do you like to write? When do you not like to write? Do you have a word limit that you like to do during the day? Or was it 16 years and it took you like a word a year?
I am a pretty slow writer because as I write, it tends, I finish each sentence before I go on to the next one. I really, it has to sound the way I want it to sound. So the writing itself tends to be pretty polished once I have a first draft. What I really need to work on as I edit tends to be more pacing and structure, you know. Uh-huh. So I tend to write whenever I can. Before I would have a very, you know, I would want to write at a very tidy desk at a certain time of day. It was all very civilized. And then once we had our girl, it got a little crazy. And I just write whenever I can. I can write in the car. I can write in the hallway, you know, at a dance class. Or it doesn't matter. I go into the zone and I just write.
Yeah.
And so, and now with, you know, with COVID and a lot of, it's gotten more challenging to find those hours that I need. I used to write during the day. Now I write more in the evening when everyone's in bed already. Too particular once you have a kid.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, your daughter's what, 12?
She's 12 now.
Yeah. Actually, you sound like just cadets in flight school. You know, you could go to sleep braced up against the wall. You can sleep anywhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the way I feel. Writing. Yeah.
Oh, let's talk about your dialogue for a minute, because Richard and I love dialogue, and we're both pretty good at writing dialogue. What did you think of her dialogue, Rich?
Yeah, I took about a semester of German, and I could almost start hearing them talking in German as I'm reading the English book.
Right.
So, the dialogue actually is one of the best ways you're going to get people to get to know the character, the way they talk.
Right.
Comes across, and you really set your characters up very well that way. So the dialogue to me was excellent.
Yeah, I it was very natural.
Oh, thank
you. Which is one of the better things we can say about a book is the dialogue. It will make or break a book as well.
Right.
I wanted it to sound German, even though it's written in English. I wanted I did not want it to sound Americanized in any way, you know, and so it had to have a feel not just of German, but of German 75 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was words you slipped in where I, you know, have forgotten probably about 99% of the German I learned 40 some odd years ago. But because of the context and the way you delivered the dialogue, I could figure out exactly what it was they were talking about. You know, it was a strange German name, but she's talking about this pot or she's talking about that plant or something. You know, it was easy to figure out, even though it's a foreign language they're right. talking in. So, right. yeah, I mean, you nailed that.
Yeah. Well, you're fluent, too. And I took German in 1965 as a sophomore in high school. You know, so, I mean, you know what I remember from my German? Passen Sie auf das Brot und die Butter, bitte.
Well, you remember
pass
more
the
than
red
I
butter, please.
That's helpful. That'll get you your butter and bread.
That's exactly right. Oh, and Dankeschön.
Yeah.
I never could figure out the umlauts, but then that's me. I speak Italian.
It's funny. German is a very thankless language. There's a very funny Mark Twain essay. I think it's called something like The Horrible German Language. And it's very funny because he just sort of takes apart the grammar. German has basically every feature that you would want to make a language's grammar really annoying. It's got them all. It's got all the bells and whistles.
And I had a German tutor, and I learned talking with her that there are two different types of German. There's High German and Low German.
Right.
And depending if you speak Low German, you're in trouble if you're in Germany. At least back in the 80s when I was doing this, she said, you got to start talking like you know High German. I'm like, I barely understand German at all. And you want me to start getting to these, you know, different areas of it? Well, I don't even know what high is. So it's a very complex language.
It really is. It's very Germanic.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, my German teacher was out of the camps in Germany, and she came out in 1945, and she married a GI in 1950. And her son was in my class, actually, Mrs. Rena, and she was a very nice lady, tall, statuesque German lady. Mm-hmm. I guess her father had done something to piss Hitler off or piss off the regime, and he wound up in a camp. They weren't Jewish, but a lot of Germans wound up in camps that weren't Jewish. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the theme of the book, you know, is that you try to resist and you could well end up in the camp. I think German is, in many ways, it's an annoying language to learn, but it's also fun. If you like the sort of ins and outs of grammar, and if you like Latin or, you know, other languages that have a lot of inflection and just complexity, then it's a fun language.
Yeah, because German has a masculine, a feminine, and a neuter. Is that correct?
Yes, it has that, and it has cases, you know, right. So you have your nominative and your genitive and your dative and your accusative. But then it gets even crazier because depending on whether you know, which article you're using, a definite article like the or an indefinite an article like then the endings for the adjectives change, and it's just insanity. I mean, it's like trying to juggle not three balls but like 10 balls at the same time.
Which some Germans can do, incidentally.
Like
Italian has masculine, feminine, and neuter. It has more tenses than I care to think about. Mm-hmm. And if you grow up in an Italian family, you learn Italian by self-protection. Because when your parents are yelling and your name comes up, you better know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Or just not be there when they're talking about you. That might be your best bet.
What did you find was the hardest part about writing this book? I understand you did an outline.
I did not. I outlined after I had the first
pantser. Pantser. We love pantsers. We do.
No outline. I let the characters sort of take me where they were going to take me. And then I printed out this monster. And then once I had the first draft, I outlined what I had and sort of looked at what I still needed to do.
Did you find that when we ask this question to almost every writer that comes on the show, did you find that once you got into the story that your character started dictating what they were going to do next?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's the most fun part for me, is letting the character take over. It's sort of the Ouija board, you know, approach to writing. That's what I love the most. And there were moments where I did not want to write a particular scene because it was painful and I was going to have to say goodbye to, you know, one character or the other. And so I would research and research and research to try to avoid writing the scene. And in every instance, the character, it was almost like they shook me and said, that's enough of the research. Just write the damn thing.
You know? Yeah, write the story. Yeah, Richard and I did a book together. And we found that the characters definitely dictated where they were going. Although we knew beforehand, but how they got there was all totally them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was and it was a fun ride. It was a fun read. It was a fun ride too. But
I never saw the thing with the horse coming, but there it was. You know, we have a little bit going through the back half of the book where one character is griping about the horse that got shot out from under him, and the other character has just about had enough of that and finally just tells him he's going to put him on an old honorary mule or something. So it was, but that was not planned. That was nowhere.
No,
in
it just
the
came
outline.
Out. The line kind of is the horse gets killed, and as they're walking down the street, he goes, "You know, I always really liked that horse," and the guy named Crockett says, or David Crockett Hall, he goes, "Well, there's other horses." Armstrong says, "Yeah, but I like that one."
It's funny. No, I mean, it's always a surprise, and that's the sort of terrifying part about you don't know where you're going, but right. It's also the exhilarating part. And I always compare it to sort of Spider-Man, you know, sort of swinging from building to building. It's exhilarating to swing, but it's also a little terrifying because you have to figure out where to throw your net next.
But you know, I think in the long run, as you're allowing the characters to not so much dictate but guide you, it opens up a whole new area for you to write into, whereas you may not have had that or thought about it before.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it gives you a whole different direction to go if you want to go that way.
Exactly. I think an outline limits you in some ways. If you it constrains you because you're writing to the outline.
Correct.
You know, but some people can make that work, and you know, they're able to imagine ahead of time exactly what they want, and so then the outline is a way for them to sort of guide them to their vision. But for me, I don't know what the vision is. The characters
right.
of the vision, and they're gonna reveal themselves to me.
Okay, and now comes a question we ask all the writers, this question. Have you ever had writer's block in the 16 years it took you to write this book? Did you ever get writer's block? And if you did, how did you get out of it? And if you haven't, how did you avoid it?
You know, I honestly think when I have had instances where I won't say I was blocked, but where writing was really difficult for me and I didn't want to do it. I was almost like a horse sort of shying away from something. I think it was because there was a problem with what I was trying to do.
Uh-huh.
There was a structural problem or there was something that wasn't true to the characters. And so I intuitively just didn't want to proceed. And I didn't have another way to proceed. I hadn't sort of thought of a way out of the sort of corner that I was painted into. And so I think the way for me, the way I got out of that was just, again, looking to the characters to be my guide. Because
right.
once they can guide me out of any corner, you know, if I sort of
sure.
got myself trapped in like a maze somewhere, they'll guide me back out. But you have to trust them to do that for you.
Right. And when the character jumps off the page and looks at you as an Annette, you can always walk across the fresh paint.
Yeah. That's true too. That is true too.
Don't let Jim give you too much grief about putting the novel away for 8 years, because I wrote a story, put it away, came back to it, and finally published it 37 years later.
Well,
so eight years is nothing. So
nothing.
Yeah.
So anyway, don't go away. Just a second, Annette. We're going to take another real quick break, and then we'll come back to you. We're going to be back right after this short break, and this is LA Talk Radio. We're listening to The Writer's Block, and we are honored and proud to have this short ad for Creative Edge.
Hi, Jim Christina here for Creative Edge Publicity. And you know, there's a reason that authors flock to Creative Edge. Yes, it's true, and no one would believe it, but it is true. Creative Edge, the grassroots publicity firm that has stayed community-minded, is growing. And not only growing, but busting right out of their seams. With a client base of over 70 authors, 2 New York Times bestsellers, 6 USA Today bestsellers, and multiple international bestsellers and award winners, Creative Edge in 4 years has become one of the mainstays in the publicity book market. offering reader-focused opportunities in all levels of media, including podcasts, radio, TV, print, and much more. When it comes to publicity, Mickey Mickelson and Creative Edge are experts in the book industry. Look him up at www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future.
And Mickey, of course, is a good friend of the show, and we have at least one of his authors on a month. And we're just pleased as punch that Mickey is part of our production facility. Anyway, so question.
Where were you going with that, Jim?
I have no clue. I often, my brain gets way faster than my mouth. So that's what happens.
As you're
writing and you're sitting down and you're thinking of something else, do you ever come up with another novel idea while you're writing?
I do. I tend to jot things down as they come to me. If there's a sentence that comes to me, sometimes I don't even know where that sentence is going to end up, but I jot it down because it usually finds its way into something. You know, my story started as a poem. And so I wrote this poem. I had no idea what it was about or where it was going. And yet there it was. It was the short story, just not ready to be born yet, you know?
Right.
And the other thing that I think is so important for writers, especially in their sort of early stage, is not to be afraid of rejection. You know, one of my stories got rejected 77 times before it got published in a journal. And then it ended up winning. It was like part of the O. Henry Prize stories anthology.
Oh, wow.
You know, I just think it's so important to start submitting your stuff when it's as good as you can make it, when you're really happy with it. And then if you get rejected, just keep going. Don't be discouraged by that because you're in the game, you know?
Right.
I would get excited when I got rejections because I'd be like, well, I'm in the game. Yeah. This one didn't work out, but, you know, and then as the rejections became personalized, you know, I see something in the story, send more. Well, those poor editors will never forgive themselves for doing that because I send more and more and more, you know, because you just have to put it out there. If you want people to read your work, if it's rejected, that's life. You know, you're going to get rejected a lot.
Do you have an agent, right?
I do. Yeah.
How many times did you query an agent before you got an agent?
You know, it's funny with the first draft of The Vanishing Sky, I queried, I'd say a few agents, not like a crazy number, a few. And I had people requesting the full and coming really close to taking it, but then nothing. And so then I wrote short stories and I ended up getting the book through a contest, the Mary McCarthy Prize, you know. And so it was published by a small publishing house, Saraband. And one of those stories was published in One Story, which is a really excellent journal. The story came out in One Story. All of a sudden, I had agents really interested in working with me. And so I met with the different agents, and I just really liked the agent that I ended up, you know, and I'm still with. So I think, you know, I wasn't that worried about finding an agent. I was worried about or focused on getting the stories out there. And once the stories were out there, the agents found me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's, you brought up that you don't want writers getting discouraged when they get the rejection letters. My first book, I queried 188 agents before I got one.
Wow.
And then it was another year and we queried, I want to say about 60 publishers before somebody picked it up.
Yeah.
So yeah, you got to keep grinding and you can't get that rejection letter, especially when you get a full request, and we got three or four of those.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, this is it. You get the rejection letter. You want to quit, but you know, you don't. You just keep plowing away at it and keep going.
Yeah. I felt like I was a Terminator, you know, like you just like knocking me down. I get right back up and I keep on running. I thought I have these stories and I'm just going to keep sending them out. I will be relentless.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a friend of mine that has spiral notebooks with all these rejection letters in it and plus in page covers.
Wow.
Wow.
And, you know, it's like, why? He said, it's a reminder.
Yeah.
you know, okay, I get that. But there's like the real thick bikers. There's like three of them. He's kind of just lined up on the shelf.
Well, I kept my first one from my freelance days in 1983 because the way it was written was rather mean. And I used it as motivation to keep going and to get better. But after a couple of years, I threw it in the trash because I didn't need that motivation anymore. But I wouldn't keep – I mean, my God, I'd have a bookshelf full of rejection letters if I did that.
Right. Yeah. Well, we don't – Richard and I don't – we do reject manuscripts, but we don't do it badly. I mean
– No.
We give the writers a chance to clean it up and do some rewriting and then resubmit.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's fair to the writer because your first draft isn't always your best. And we know that, you know. And so you give them an opportunity and give them some hints. And if they don't follow them, then that's their fault. And bye-bye. But, you know, if they do follow them and they try very hard, we can work with them a little bit. So.
Yeah. Well, I think kindness. I mean, I think, you know, there's no point in being mean to someone. No. And just because you don't like something doesn't mean someone else might not like it. You know, I mean, I think that's the thing. People have such varied responses to writing that you just don't know. It's very unpredictable.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I hate to tell you this, but we are out of time. And
well,
this has gone really fast, I have to say. And you have been an absolute delight. Can you let our audience know where they can find you and via Facebook or whatever you want to give them?
Sure. Well, I've got a website, ellenettebinder.com, and I also blog on Goodreads. Other than that, I don't do the socials. I'm sort of a reclusive New Hampshire lady out in the field.
That might not be such a bad thing.
Yeah, not such a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, we have a web page for Tuscany Bay, and we have one for the radio show, but that's pretty much it for us. So, well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a hoot having you, and your book, of course, is The Vanishing Sky, and it is available on Amazon because I did check it out. And if it's available on Amazon, it's pretty much available on all the online booksellers. You can order it, and if they don't have it, just give them the ISBN and the Library of Congress number, and they'll get it for you. Thank you so much, Annette, for joining us. It's been really, really a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Richard. It's been lovely.
It's been lovely for us as well. Next week, I do not have our guest, but I will tell you that next week, of course, that Tuscany Bay is going to be the major advertiser on the Writer's Block again. Richard will be joining us full-time and permanently, and Bobby Jean Bell will still be with us, and so will Russ Avison. So we'll have four hosts coming up, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And right now, for Richard Polinelli, hi, Rich! Hi, Rich!
Don't go Adios!
For Richard Polinelli, myself, Bobby Jean Bell, and of course, Russ Avison, Ronan Rosner, and the man himself, Sam Hassan, we are out of here.